You are listening in to Mediapolis Now, the podcast channel of Mediapolis, a journal of cities and culture. This is our events podcast series in which we feature recordings of recent talks and symposia at the junction of cities, culture, and media. I am your host, Scott Rogers. This episode includes excerpts from four interviews from the 9th European Communication Conference, held in Aarhus, Denmark, 19th through 22nd October 2022. The ECC is the biennial conference of the European Communication Research and Education Association, or ECREA, and in 2022, the conference theme was Rethink Impact, exploring how communication studies, broadly defined, interacts with, impacts on, and reflects society. The four interviews here are with scholars who presented at the conference in one of the sessions organized through ECREA's section on media, cities, and space. And full disclosure, I'm on the management team for this section. Each of the interviews were recorded in this compact, mobile podcast van. The van was a collaboration between Aarhus Public Library Dock 1 and the newspaper Jyllands Posten. During the conference, the van was parked just outside one of the main conference buildings at the Aarhus University campus. All the interviews you hear were facilitated by Christoph Raich, executive produced by J.V. Marasigan-Pangan, with Chance Dorland as audio engineer and trainer. The interviews themselves were hosted by Erasmus Mundus journalism students from Aarhus University, who I will introduce alongside the guests, producer, and support staff as we go along. You'll be hearing excerpts from these interviews, where the host discusses with the guests the research they presented at the conference. The first interview is with Lisa Schultz, who spoke with Martina Hrgović. The producer was Saskia Riemann, with Nariman Mustafa on staff. Lisa is a doctoral candidate at the Department of Communication Studies at the University of Salzburg, in Austria. We jump in here with Martina briefly asking Lisa about her background before turning to the research she presented at the conference, exploring how wheelchair users in five German cities navigate their movements with the help of digital and other media.
Hello, Lisa. Good day.
Hello. Thank you. Yeah.
Before we start to talk about your research, can you tell us a bit more about yourself?
Yes, I can. I am a PhD student at the University of Salzburg. And I work in the unit for media use and digital cultures.
And can you introduce us to your research? What was the motivation to start dealing with this topic?
Yeah, well, I think my interest came from working in a project with my professor, Christine Lohmeier, on navigation tools. We examined how people used Google Maps. And during this process of working with the people who use Google Maps, we started to see that different user groups, so to say, use Google Maps differently. And so I just started thinking about wheelchair users, so people with disabilities in general. And so this project began as how do wheelchair users use navigation tools? And yeah, that's pretty much where it came from.
So it was a very practical nature. You started to interview people that are using Google Maps to navigate, and then you realized, okay, what about people in wheelchairs? How do we approach interviewing them? And
yeah, exactly. And also because there's not a lot of research on navigation tools from a perspective that is more from the social studies. So we have a lot of research on navigation media from, for example, human-computer interaction, where you see how software might hold certain potentials for certain user groups, but not really as a whole process that is embedded in social settings.
And can you tell me, how did you approach these interviews? How many interviewees did you have, and what did you actually do that is not included in the classical concept of interview?
Well, yeah, just let me begin with how many people I could interview, because the work is really quite dense. As for now, I have worked with five people and I did several interview types. I did online interviews, I did the moving interview that I'm probably going to talk about more in a bit. And those interviews are very intense because they take a lot of time. And that is probably one thing that is, I hope it is quite unique to this work that I'm doing. Because I do follow people, one participant at a time, through the entire process of planning and following a route. So I experience pretty much where they live, what environments they move in, what media they use while planning their routes, how they use them, and also how they move in space, what kinds of, what elements of space are important to them or hinder movement, encourage movement. And I'm not only talking about elements like, for example, a streetlight or a high curb or something, but also how are people around those participants that I follow, what role do they play?
So you really get immersed in their lived experience of mm-hmm. everyday commuting or going from point A to point B, like things that we take for granted usually.
Yeah, I think so. Mm.
So you introduced the concept of moving interview. Can you please tell us moving interview versus walking interview? What are the differences? Why is there a need for a moving interview?
The moving interview pretty much builds on the concept of the walking interview. The core of it is that we move while we speak, and not only speak, but while I get to experience what the participant experiences. I chose the term moving interview to kind of get the focus of the bodily part of this interview away from walking as moving your 2 feet to get from one place to another, to the part that you actually move. And it doesn't really matter what your body does or how it does it, how it does the movement. There is, for example, in the very beginning of my project, I thought about how about I use a wheelchair too, because I'm not a wheelchair user, but trying to learn how to use a wheelchair was so, so complicated for me. I tried it for a few days. It really didn't work. I was not in the physical capacity to hold myself. As soon as there was the slightest slope, I would just roll backwards. I'm sure there's different ways, and people who are much fitter than me could probably do that in a lot faster than I could. But so I came up with the idea, why not just get the center of the movement away from the body and just call it a moving interview, which it is. I move, they move, so we just move.
And can you reflect a little bit on how other research methods besides interview are excluding for people that are disabled or in a wheelchair?
I think it's an underlying thing that we do not really think about or speak about, the fact that the methods that are so commonly used in qualitative research do require certain bodily functions. For example, now that we speak, that we are having an interview, it is required that we both speak in a way that we can understand each other. And also that I was able to get up these stairs to this little podcast van here. It's just a lot of these features that we probably don't really reflect on. And we could find ways to change that, I think. I'm not trying to point a finger at these methods. They are important and we need them. And I just want to get us all to think about how can we think more about changing methods to be more inclusive, even just to think about it. Because if you look at studies that you've read, probably you don't really read a lot of studies where they have people with disabilities in their sample or as researchers. I'm hoping to get more openness to that.
Do you think that we can talk about real representativeness if people, disabled people, are not usually included in research samples?
Oftentimes I think it is about a pragmatic decision. I think researchers, or well, anybody who does research, somehow tends to think that you do not want to make the whole situation more complicated or even dangerous for people. So it's probably not about researchers being mean for excluding people from their research. It's more an approach to do the best they can without risking anybody's health or without making a project more difficult than it already is. But maybe that is not necessary. Maybe it is not more complicated or even dangerous for someone if we just think about it more.
And how did your interviewees receive this new type of interview? What were their reactions?
I think they enjoyed it. I think it was overall a really nice experience for both of us. Also, that is probably one thing particular to this group or to other groups that are often marginalized in our societies, because they are the interview partners that I had were really much wanting to show me how they used, for example, Google Maps, what functions their wheelchair had and how to overcome, for example, a little step on the street. So they were so much explaining me how everything worked that helped me so much in understanding that, because that is, I think, something really important. I am not a wheelchair user, so I'm not used to, for example, being able to walk around 20, the speed of an electronic wheelchair, for example, is up to 20 kilometers per hour. So they had to drive much slower for me so that I could cope with how fast they could go. Yeah. So yeah, overall, it was a really nice experience, I think. Yeah.
So the adjustment, it goes both ways, right?
Mm-hmm.
How is this research going to impact the future of research and our everyday lives as well?
Oh, that's a good question. Well, I hope that maybe in the future, especially now speaking for navigation media, that we no longer have options that are bound to certain bodies. So that we no longer have a specific route for people who go by foot, for bicycle users or for car users, but maybe more like different factors that we could choose from to plan a route that is perfect for each individual. That is probably pretty much what's what I think is needed. Yeah. So, for example, if you use a pram or if you have heavy luggage, I don't know, or if you use a wheelchair or maybe if you use another kind of aid, you could then plan a route without thinking about the factor of disability, but just for the factors that you need and that everybody needs.
And before we end our discussion, I'm sure that there are going to be listeners who will be very interested in your research. Where can they find it?
Oh, my research, you could find that as soon as it's published. The dissertation is not finished yet, but there is a paper on media studies. It's a journal from the Czech Republic. You could find that online. It's called Moving Interviews. And yeah, just have a look at that and also take a look at our website of the University of Salzburg. And if there's any questions, you can always send me an email. Be happy to answer that.
Okay, and what is your email address or some kind of contact on social media maybe?
I'm not so good with social media, but the email address is lisa.schulze@plus.ac.at.
In the second interview, Karin Larsson speaks with Marcela Sanchez. The producer was Abhishek Kumar with Ramisha Ali on staff. Karin is a doctoral candidate in Media and Communication Studies at Södertörn University in Stockholm, Sweden. We join Marcela asking Karin about her background before turning to the research she presented at the conference around VDNKH, a Stalinist exhibition area in Moscow. They discuss how Karin came to study this site and what it reveals about urban mediations of authoritarian and national conservative tendencies in Russia today.
Let's start talking about you, where you're from. Tell us a little bit about your academic background.
Yes, so I'm currently a PhD student at Södertörn University. I started my PhD in 2019, so about 3 years ago, and around this time I'm halfway through my doctoral education.
And why this topic? Why did you choose to research this topic?
Well, it's a kind of a long story. My initial idea was to study the smart city in a Russian context. So I did my master's thesis on the smart home and how the smart home arranges our daily lives, how it arranges and organizes time and space. So I scaled that idea up to the smart city and thought it would be interesting to look at the smart city in a Russian context, in a more non-Western context and in a authoritarian context. But then the pandemic happened after like 5 months into the project. And my initial plan was, of course, to go to Moscow to do some field work, which I couldn't for a couple of years. So I had to rethink my project quite a bit. That is how I ended up with the exhibitions in Venice instead. That was more easy to access with a vaccine passport. So I went there last fall, and still I haven't been to Russia. So it's been a windy road.
And how did you feel presenting? Was this your first time presenting this research topic?
No, it was the second time.
How did it feel?
It felt good. I had been practicing back in my hotel room for almost the entire day yesterday. So once I was up there, I felt quite calm, actually.
Well, now I want to talk more about your research. I know it looks at the Stalinist exhibition area in Moscow named Vedenka. So tell us a little bit more about this site.
Yes, this site is a huge exhibition complex. It is a park with, I think today it has over 60 pavilions for different kinds of exhibitions and expos and stuff. But it was built on the initiative of the Stalin regime in 1930s as one of the major projects of the then ongoing renewal of Moscow. So it was one of the great construction sites or construction projects besides, for example, the Moscow Metro, which is perhaps more well-known outside Russia than Vinnytsia. So after the fall of the Soviet Union, the Vinnytsia was privatized to a very high extent. It was commercialized. There were like market halls in these very special pavilions. And people went there for barbecues and picnics. And it was not as prominent, perhaps, as it was during the Soviet times when this was like the shiny pearl of socialism, showing the socialist paradise.
And, you know, I also want to ask you about the material you used to study Vinnytsia, especially because you were conducting most of this research during the pandemic, right? And you weren't able to travel to Moscow. So what material did you use to research on this topic when you couldn't visit, you know?
Yeah, that's how I ended up with the Venice stuff, because I found out that they had made an exhibition at the Architectural Biennale in Venice a few years earlier than this Vinnytsia exhibition, which was on a smart city site in Moscow called Skolkovo. And when I looked into that exhibition, which was very, very different from the one I presented yesterday, I then started to looking around, okay, so what other kinds of exhibition have they showed in Venice? And that's how I found the Vinnytsia exhibition.
And how would you say Vinnytsia embodies the authoritarian and national conservative Russia of today?
I can't really give you a general answer, because I can only speak from the material that I look into in my research. But what surprised me and what got me interested in this very particular exhibition was the contrast between the exhibition on the Skolkovo area in 2012, which was all about the digital and about the connections between Moscow and other cities and the very good relations between Russia and the West, for example. And the pavilion was covered in QR codes, and the visitors went around with tablets just scanning the codes and reading about this project. And then 4 years later, they have this completely different exhibition of the Vinnytsia, which then, in contrast, appears as something that is both very Soviet nostalgic or romanticizing the Stalinist authoritarianism or totalitarianism, as it was. And it also, in contrast to this Skolkovo exhibition, it seemed super analog. And at this time, it was also after the Russian invasion of Ukraine, and it was a completely different take on what Russia wanted to signal to the world from this pavilion in Venice. It was not about connecting to the West, it was about looking inwards, turning back to the Soviet past for some kind of, I don't know, yeah, glorification of totalitarianism. It wasn't, of course, they said in the exhibition catalog, and the producers said, like, no, this area, it's free from ideology. It's just an infrastructure. We can do whatever we want with this. It has nothing to do with Stalinism. Stalinism was awful, of course. But still, there is something with this giant exhibition area that they want to use to, as they say, foster the people, that it should be a site of culture and education and not for commerce or cheap, spontaneous pleasures. That is something that doesn't sound that far from what we call authoritarianism.
Yeah, and you also argued that the Vinnytsia is not just a nostalgic space from Russia's past, but it also describes Moscow as a media complex. Can you tell us more about the concept behind media complex?
Yes and no. Because this was a concept that I tried to work with in my project, to try to frame the city as a complex of media technologies and media practices and media logistics and representation, all these kinds of media technologies connecting to each other and then like broadcasting the city to the world. But as you can hear, this was a very, very, very wide and broad concept, and I realized that this says nothing. It has to be more specific. So I actually took it out from my project, and I don't use the media complex concept anymore. I cut it out from my Word document and put it in a trash document. So maybe I can, maybe I will take it back.
Later. Yeah. Yeah. That's part of research. You know, you gather so much, you delete things, you think you're going to include something. But I also want to ask you, if you had to summarize your research into three main key points for our listeners, people who weren't able to attend your session, what would those three takeaways be?
Oh my God, this is my supervisors always tell me to be more concise, and she tried to frame my project and be more specific. And we have tried to squeeze it down for 3 years now. But yeah, okay. So I would say I study how ideas of the city and of urban media technologies in Russia are communicated in a Western context.
I love that. You know, because we also have listeners who, you know, aren't academics and aren't familiar with this research. So I love the way, very concise. And also, if people want to read more about your research, where can they find more information?
They can find my research profile at sh.se. It's the website of Södertörn University. But I haven't published anything yet. So they have to wait for another couple of years or so before I actually have some results to present.
And you said that your research is not done.
Yeah.
So what's next for you?
Next, now I'm trying to actually write the 60% manuscript that I will present to my colleagues. And they will say, okay, Karin, this is interesting, but you have to do this and this and this and this. So I'm really in the process of trying to make all the kind of ideas and material and theories that I have to make them just align a little bit more than they do at the moment.
Amazing. Well, I was actually in your session yesterday and I found this topic very interesting. So I definitely encourage our listeners to, once it's published, go out and read more about this really interesting topic.
In our third interview, you'll hear Moritz Schweiger speaking with Malene Solheim. The producer was Andy Penefuerte III with Abhishek Kumar on staff. Moritz is a doctoral candidate at the Department for Media, Knowledge, and Communication at Augsburg University in Germany. We come in with Malene asking Moritz about his main object of research, augmented reality. They go on to discuss the many possibilities and problems of these technologies for urban life and even societies in general.
You have done some research on augmented reality, right?
That's right.
And for people, including myself, who's not very familiar with this, could you explain what it is, please?
So augmented reality means that you see virtual objects in your real vision. So in one word, holograms. People know that from sci-fi movies like Star Wars or Star Trek, when virtual objects are just portrayed or shown in the real world. And that's basically what augmented reality is. So the word in a literal sense means to make more of reality or to portray something, to show something that's not there, that's not real. But people who are wearing these augmented reality glasses or augmented reality devices, they see it as real. So imagine just your regular perspective. We're sitting here, we're watching the lake at the campus, but you are the only one who sees a virtual object there, and I don't, because you're the one who's wearing AR glasses or who's pointing their phone. Pokemon Go would be also an example of augmented reality that maybe most people can relate to.
Yeah, I was thinking about Pokemon Go. And also, there's a lot of these Snapchat filters that use this, where there's nothing on the table, but you put your phone up and then you see a little dancing figure or something.
Yeah, yeah. Those are the most famous examples. But however, they are what we call handheld augmented reality. So it's based on devices that you're holding in your hand. You always have to point it towards the object to see it. But at least for me, the more interesting devices would be the ones that you're actually like glasses, AR glasses. And there are some AR glasses there on the market yet. However, they're pretty expensive and an experimental phase. But we hope, especially as researchers, that the moment will come that those AR glasses will be more available and also more cheap. And then that will be head-worn devices that you wear on your head.
So what would be the purpose of these AR glasses? Are they only entertainment purposes, or can you use it for other things?
So there are many fields possible that AR can change our life and that those devices could change the way we perceive things. The first field that is always mentioned will be tourism. So even now there are AR apps for tourism. For instance, in Berlin, it's possible to show the Berlin Wall as a hologram on your mobile phone while you're standing there, or to have virtual tour guides, virtual tours to cities with holograms being shown of ancient buildings that are not even there. And that actually brings me to my research, because we did something similar. We reconstructed a building that has been destroyed. It's no longer there. It's a historical building in Augsburg. And yeah, we reconstructed it as a hologram there. But you mentioned the fields. So in short, tourism, medicine is also possible. If doctors rehearse their operations, not on a real body, but are shown on their glasses, okay, put the knife here, place it there. So training for medicine might be an option, but also city planning. So when it comes to showing how a new building facade will look like to the people living there, to the citizens, to promote the building and the construction of the building, AR might be an option. Look, this is, we want to rebuild this and that, or we want to reconstruct this. Augmented reality might be a way to show it in a very simple and visual way. That's how it might look.
That is super interesting, because you're not leaving it only up to your own imagination, but it's kind of a way to make it more concrete, and that you can visualize and you can see it in front of you, even though it's not there. It's an amazing tool.
Yeah. And it's, the best part of it is that it's an overlay. It's like a new layer that you put on top of the real world, and you see virtual objects. You don't have to describe them. You don't have to explain what they are. You just show them, and people instantly know, okay, that's what he or she is talking about. That's what it's all about. So it will simplify a lot of things. To put it short, it has the potential to simplify a lot of things in our daily life.
It's kind of this one picture shows more than 1,000 words. And
exactly. And one hologram shows more than 1,000 pictures.
Yeah, there we go. Yeah. Oh, very interesting. So when you're talking about this now, I'm thinking about maybe you can use it in even in history classes. You know, when it's becoming accessible, you say that it's quite inaccessible and expensive right now.
Mm-hmm.
But maybe in a few years or in many years, when this has become more accessible, maybe it would be possible to use it in history class. Oh, this was how... I don't know. Berlin looked like before the fall of the wall, for example.
Right.
I'm also a student of journalism, right? And we often talk about the power of visualizing your storytelling and using visual elements. Mm-hmm. So, and this also goes for education, right? Learning anything, right?
Exactly.
And I think for that was at least what I thought about, that this could be an amazing learning tool that you just see it there and you don't need to explain anything. It's just there.
Yeah. Not only for history, so history is the thing that comes to your mind first, but also for other disciplines. So it's the possibilities are endless, and I'm really curious how this will end up in the future. Maybe not too distant in the future. You're talking about many years. Maybe it's even closer than we think.
So you sound optimistic, but are there bad things, challenges about implementing these kinds of technologies into urban planning or medicine or education or tourism?
Yes, of course, there is always a downside to it. And the downside would be what you might call an information overflow or a sensual overflow. Maybe you've seen also in pop cultural movies where when there are so many holograms in your vision that you actually cannot see or perceive the real world anymore. Imagine you're wearing, in the future, you're wearing these glasses and 80% of your vision are covered with holographic advertisements or illustrations, pop-ups. So there is a risk that it will add to that information overflow and also forms of digital stress that people are experiencing already now just with a smartphone. So that might be a risk, but it always ends up to the user, what he or she makes out of this technology. And there are people who get along with their smartphones and the opportunities, but also the risks that it gets with it pretty well. And others feel overwhelmed by the technology. So it's always up to you what you make out of it.
Yeah, but with everything, right? That goes with the telephone and the TV and the phone. Yeah, with everything.
Another risk will be or might be that in when it comes to power mechanisms and to regulating what people see in the augmented reality. So imagine a square, a huge central city square, like the one we used in our study, for example. Certain content, augmented reality content, certain holograms are only available to the ones who pay for it or who are more fortunate than others who are less fortunate. So that's also an issue that will be have to taken into account. So who is allowed to see what in the augmented reality and who decides what is shown in a certain place? So who decides, okay, at that particular place in the city, this hologram can be shown, and at that particular place, another one can be shown. Who decides what will be shown in a certain place, and who decides what cannot be shown?
Yeah, that's quite interesting, because then the people who can afford to produce and to buy and to distribute this kind of technology, they automatically have some sort of power, no?
Exactly.
Of course, this is a context specific to the AR, but this is also what we see in many other things. And this is also the challenge with implementing new technologies, because there's going to be an owner of that technology. There's going to be owner of the companies that use this technology.
Yeah.
So now I don't know if you've done the research on this specifically, but is there a way to kind of avoid that kind of biasness and kind of this one man who owns this entire technology?
I think, just like with other technologies, it will depend on the participation of regular users. So if they are willing to fight for this technology, to fight for it in terms of fighting for their right to use it in the way they want to use it, and not being dependent on officials telling them, okay, this is how we use augmented reality, or better, this is how we want you to use it, then there is a potential that this technology will have great opportunities for everyone and that we can avoid this dystopian forms that it might take.
Very interesting. Yeah, and kids maybe that will grow up using this technology, maybe it will be then important for them to learn what you just pointed out, to know on what conditions they want to use this technology,
yeah.
That it's not, as you say, like 80% of what you see is only a virtual reality created.
Yeah. It definitely, we definitely will have to adapt the way we teach children about this technology. The aspect of media literacy is really important, so that we, again, just like you teach your kid how to use a smartphone, we will have to teach them how to use this technology. Don't be too dependent on it. Don't let it block your entire perception all of the time, but just use it where it makes sense and where it doesn't take you or draw you too much out of the real world.
Because we want to be grounded in the real world, won't we?
Yeah, we don't want this technology to draw us too much out of the real world.
Finally, we joined Darya Ozcan being interviewed by Radha Puranik, with Saskia Riemann producing and Nariman Mustafa on staff. Darya is an assistant professor in the Faculty of Communication at İzmir University of Economics in Turkey. We pick up here with Radha turning to the feedback Darya received at the conference, before they move on to exploring her research project, which created an ambitious, publicly accessible digital map of former movie theaters, presenting them as cultural heritage sites in İzmir, Turkey.
Of course, you got some feedback at the end of your presentation yesterday. So did you get any like valuable things that you can maybe apply or maybe talk about with your peers?
Yeah, sure. This project is an interesting project. Maybe I can slowly go into talking about the project a little bit. For me, it's very different from all the other projects I have done so far, especially in the sense that it started not from a preconceived theoretical framework. I have been a very like theory focused person in my academic life, but this time it just emerged out of just simple curiosity. So I don't really think about theory that much at the very beginning, and then now I'm thinking about theory in retrospect. So in that sense, the presentation here was important to kind of get some feedback to see which directions this research can go.
I was going to ask you about the theoretical framework, but then you answer that for me. It must have taken blood, sweat, and tears to finish this research project. But let's go back to where it started. Can you still remember the first time that you thought of this big idea and why this project?
Yeah. I remember that very, very well. I was on my way to do some paperwork for my license plate for my car. And I was new in the city of Izmir at the time. I had just moved there. And I had to walk this, like, I don't know, like 5 minutes distance from the office to the train station. And then I just found myself passing by this building. It looked like a ghost to me. And there was some sign, it said Büyük Cinema, the Grand Theater. And then there were all these other more recent signs. Mm-hmm. Apparently it's been a storage space for something else. So it was a rundown building. Looked very, very interesting to me. So that day I took a photograph of that building. And then I have been, like, I started after that thinking about, can we do a project on old movie theaters in Izmir? Like, I mean, there must be a lot more of these. So that was the beginning. And then I got an invitation to be part of a not research, but arts and culture event, which was supported by this consortium in Turkey, but supported by the EU, Spaces of Culture. So this was a larger project that involved some interventions, cultural interventions in urban space. And then I was invited to be part of it. And I took that as an opportunity to start working on this project.
Amazing. Thank you. This year's theme is Rethink Impact. Researchers are challenged to produce projects that are not just about bridging the gap in the academic literature, but also produce a sustained, lasting impact. Your project about mapping movie theaters in Buja. Tell us in short detail, in what ways does it rethink the impact of communications?
Thank you. That's a really great question that I'm very happy to get because this project, in terms of its impact on the community, was kind of like very, it was a project for which it was very, very important to have the impact and to have the communication with the community. So maybe I can give a quick snapshot of the place and the context we worked in. So it's this municipal district in Izmir, the biggest municipal district in Izmir, a little marginalized in the urban imaginary, but it has a great history of, especially in the 19th century, housing non-Muslim populations in Smyrna at the time. And there are parts of the district which are under architectural preservation, very nice architectural fabric. And we worked in one of these very small preserved areas. So what we did was basically learn from the community. We did a lot of interviews with people living there. And people living there are really very tightly connected to each other. They have been living there almost for a century now. And we learned from them. And then what we learned from them, we put into the form of information, or let's say a form of knowledge, in the form of a map and an exhibition. We did an exhibition. We did an exhibition in the Buja Community Center of the Buja Association. So it was kind of like taking something from them and giving it back to them. And the exhibition was the first step to share, like, everything we learned with the local people. And then the second step was, again, very important to us. We donated this exhibition to the Buja municipality and then permanently installed it in a youth center where they have a cinematheque. Now the exhibition is permanently installed on the walls of the foyer of the cinematheque. So we are very happy that it's back in its own context.
And it's so lovely because watching things, watching movies, the way you watch them has evolved so much over time. But it's so important to put this out there and concretize this, like solidify this for the generations to come, that this is how it used to be. Mm-hmm. And I think that's really beautiful. How do you think researchers and academics are transforming the communications field these days? Do you have any opinion on the people here? Have you spoken to anyone?
I don't really know about that. So, like, I think twice before I answer the question, but I can give you an impression. The impression I have is that research is more and more going to the direction of connecting with the communities, environments. You know, like, academia has a history of being very isolated, but that's kind of like being overcome slowly. It is really slow. But like academics are kind of like realizing, discovering their limits as long as they stay within the walls of academia and finding out about the potentials of actually going outside of those walls and connecting with the subjects they are talking about. So, I mean, breaking this kind of a subject-object relationship between the researcher and the ones being researched. Mm-hmm. And I really like that. I think like academia is going that direction, which should go further in that direction.
I think before we end our discussion, there will surely be listeners out there who'd like to know more about your work. Where can we find your work?
Well, I mean, if you Google my name, you'll find my university website. Mm-hmm. There's some information there and definitely on academia.edu. I have a page as well and with some of my published and unpublished written work.
This work is still in the works, so can we find this?
This one has not been published yet. Hopefully it will be published in some form. You can find information on it on the exhibition and the digital map. I mean, the digital map is available, open access, as an interactive map. So there's, unfortunately here we cannot show it, but there's a QR code that you can scan and then go to the map and basically read about and look at the...
Can you tell us the website of the exhibition? Do you have
the exhibition website? The exhibition is called Tasarım ile in Turkish, with design translated into Turkish. And underneath that, you'll have to find your way to our exhibition, which is There Used to Be a Movie Theater Here. That's the title.
I hope you enjoyed listening to these interviews from the 9th European Communication Conference, exploring themes around media, cities, and space. Stay tuned for our next episode. And in the meantime, do take a look at the Mediapolis Journal website by visiting MediapolisJournal, that's all one word, .com. That's MediapolisJournal.com, where you can find thought-provoking content such as, in Volume 7, Issue 4, Melina Guha's exploration of the work of Aleutic artist Tanya Lukin Linklater, reflecting on her preoccupation with different kinds of structure across installations, performance, poetry, and video art. Or Robert Joseph's interview with Cortland Rankin about his new book, Decline and Reimagination in Cinematic New York. Or the deep dive article by Amy Zhang, Asia Roast, and Carwin Morris, which asks, what happens when a place achieves celebrity status on social media? As part of the answer, they introduce the term Wang Hong urbanism to theorize the construction of a new urban digital spectacle in Chinese cities and beyond. I'm Scott Rogers, and you've been listening to Mediapolis Now.